and welcome to the Turkish History Podcast. Episode 19. Intermezzo. Before we begin, if you have been enjoying this podcast, I'd like to ask you to please subscribe, rate, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get this podcast. It would mean a lot to me and would help more people find the podcast. Thank you for listening. We spent last time discussing the beginning of the anarchy at Samara, how after the Turkish slave generals plopped al-Musta'in on the throne, conflict quickly arose between them. The generals Wasif and Buga the Younger seized power, but then became deeply unpopular with the bulk of the slave army. After they triggered a riot in Samara, they were forced to flee Samara to Baghdad with al-Musta'in in tow. The Turkish generals of the slave army in Samara then appointed their close friend, the Turkophilic Abbasid prince Abu Ahmad, as leader of the slave army and dragged al-Mutawakkil's son al-Mutaz out of his palace prison and made him caliph. We ended with the siege of Baghdad and the negotiated victory of the Samaran Turkish slave army and their candidate, al-Mutaz. And today, we will close out the story of the anarchy and discuss how it transformed the caliphate forever. How the caliph would cease to be the sole leader of a united caliphate, uniting in his person both spiritual and temporal power, and how the caliphate itself would come to be sundered into a patchwork of emirates. See, ever since the death of Muhammad, the caliph acted as the successor to the messenger, both as the religious leader of the Muslim community and as the temporal leader of the empire of faith. Now, there were of course wrinkles to this. There might be multiple people claiming the title of caliph, such as the Umayyads hanging on in Spain. There could be people who accepted the reality of the caliph's temporal or secular rule while still pining for a descendant of Ali. And of course, the caliphate had religious scholars and jurists with great authority on religious matters, and civil and military officials who managed the state day to day. But fundamentally, religious and political power were vested in the caliph, and crucially, they were in fact sort of seen as the same thing. There was no real difference between the caliph's role as successor to the messenger and commander of the faithful and his control over the state. One thing implied the other. The state had been created by the messenger and his successors. It had been born from the religious community, the ummah. The state was itself a creation of the religion. Now, this is a bit unique if you think about it. Think of the other states that existed at this time. The Roman Empire had, of course, existed prior to Christianity. Indeed, Christianity as something other than a fringe sect within Judaism, as the religion that it became, was basically created by Roman imperial power. It was the Roman Empire that created Christianity, not vice versa. The Sassanid Empire existed separate from the Zoroastrian clergy, as did the various Chinese dynasties from the religious establishments of their states. Now, of course, at this time, religion and the state were deeply, deeply entwined everywhere, in a way that sometimes can be hard for us to really understand today. There was no idea anywhere in the world of a truly secular state. Indeed, that idea would have been complete nonsense to the people at this time. Everywhere, the various religious establishments were deeply, deeply enmeshed with the states that they supported and that supported them. But the caliphate was nevertheless unique in that the religious establishment was the state. There simply was no difference between the two. The commander of the faithful was both the head of the religious community and the head of the state, because the two things were in essence actually the exact same thing. Now, this system had evolved since the early days. The caliphs had, for example, taken over and expanded the Persian and Roman models of government and administration, and a separate religious administration had grown up under the caliph. But at its heart, the caliphate was still an empire of faith, built on the idea that the person who led the faith led the empire. But this system was starting to fall apart as the anarchy rocked the caliphate. Indeed, we've already seen the start of this happen, and by the end of this episode, this system will be over. Instead, the caliph will become a spiritual leader only. The central administration will rule directly only in Iraq and the Hejaz, outside of which the lands of Islam will come to be ruled by emirates, emirs, who are merely recognized by the caliph. And even in the lands of Iraq, still in theory directly ruled by the caliph, the state will in fact be run by the Turkish slave generals and the religious and civil administration. In short, the caliph's spiritual power will come to be separated from his temporal power. So how did this really come to pass? First, the Turkish slave generals took so much power into their hands that they effectively started to run the state themselves. They paid merely lip service to the caliph. But then, as the war for Baghdad commenced, troops were needed closer to home, and so the provinces came to be dominated increasingly by the local nobility and the governors and military commanders. As the slave army was besieging Baghdad and the authority of the center weakened, revolts inevitably exploded everywhere, which now had to be put down by the local officials as the slave soldiers were otherwise engaged. Order had even broken down within the ranks of the slave army itself, and gangs of Turkish slave soldiers, unhappy with not being paid, had begun to rampage through the countryside of Iraq as their officers tried to corral them towards the siege. And the siege itself had been incredibly bloody, so large numbers of troops were lost, further weakening the center. So now the center was incredibly weakened, and more of the provinces fell to the rule of local nobles and officials. Now, one of these families, the Tahirids, were essentially basically the viceroys of the East already. As we discussed in episode 17, they were set up as viceroys in essence earlier during the caliphate, after helping al-Ma'mun seize the throne. They had sheltered al-Musta'in in Baghdad and led the city resisting the slave army's siege. And during the siege, the East had become in essence its own kingdom. And while they had now agreed to recognize that al-Mu'taz was caliph, they were still, in essence, the lords of their realms. But this process was now underway throughout the caliphate, not just in the east, though the Tahirids were a bit further down the path than anyone else when the siege of Baghdad ended. As the authority of the center weakened, local lords, governors, military officials, and nobles took power into their own hands. They were the ones who had to put down revolts against the state. They were the ones who had to manage the local civil administration as the anarchy raged in Samarra. Soon, they had their own local small armies at their control, and they were becoming more and more the real rulers on the ground, the people really exercising state power. The caliph was becoming more and more of a nominal overlord, the man they recognized as the commander of the faithful, and who in turn recognized them as the rulers of the provinces. In this sense, the caliph's spiritual power and temporal power were beginning to separate. Now, these local leaders came to take the title emir, meaning commander, and their realms would come to be called emirates. And as the center continued to weaken, the number of these emirates would eventually just explode. This era of emirates that would come to be born during the anarchy at Samarra is often called the intermezzo, which is Italian for intermission. Intermezzo is the word used for an intermission at an opera, and this period in many ways acts in this same way. It is the intermission between the great operatic pieces of the height of the Abbasid Caliphate and the coming great Seljuk Empire. But it didn't necessarily look that way from the beginning. So let's back up and discuss how the anarchy would ultimately end, and how it would lead to this intermezzo. In the days after the brutal, nearly year-long siege of the city of Baghdad ended, al-Mu'taz was confirmed in Samarra as the caliph. Pursuant to the terms of the negotiated surrender, Al-Musta'in recognized Al-Mu'taz as caliph in Baghdad in January 866. There were no longer two caliphs. But this resolution to the siege didn't actually solve the fundamental problem. The political situation remained more or less the same. Tensions remained between the factions of the slave army, and between the slave army on the one hand and the Tahirids and the regional emirs on the other. Indeed, the fact that the resolution of the dispute as to who was caliph didn't actually resolve anything of substance at all shows just how powerless the office of caliph had become. Perhaps most importantly, the state's ongoing fiscal crisis continued and indeed worsened. Remember that one of the reasons that Al-Mutawakkil had wanted to limit or maybe even abolish the slave army in the first place was that it was incredibly expensive. As the state's revenues had begun to decrease during the 9th century, affording this massive Turkish slave army became more and more difficult. Over half of the state's budget went to paying for the army. And at the same time, modern historians estimate that the state's revenues declined from about 500 million dirhams per annum in the early 9th century to just over 300 million dirhams per annum by the time of the siege. In other words, roughly a 30% decrease. And the anarchy had made this worse. Al-Mu'taz had been forced to agree to a special bonus equal to 10 months of salary for the Turkish slave soldiers, which the treasury just could not bear. And though Al-Musta'in was being forced to pay for part of the slave army's salaries as part of his abdication deal, there was just no way to afford this massive slave army. The rampaging Turkish slave soldiers and the fighting in Iraq itself had also done incomparable damage to the incredibly intricate millennia-old irrigation system in Iraq. This, of course, reduced agricultural yields and the state's revenues. Additionally, as the authority of the center weakened, as the emirs began to emerge as local rulers in their own right, tax revenues from the provinces began to collapse. Why on earth would the emirs send money to Samarra? They were the ones bearing the administration of their domains. They were the ones putting down these revolts. And in any event, the caliph was nothing more than a puppet of the Turkish slave army. Facing this dire situation, Al-Mu'taz attempted to reassert both the caliph's power over the slave army and the center's authority over the provinces. Remember that Al-Mu'taz was never an ally of the slave army that had ended up putting him on the throne. During the reign of his father Al-Mutawakkil, it had been his brother Al-Muntasir II who had been the favorite of the army, and who the army had then installed over his head. Then the slave army had brutally put down his attempted revolt in Samarra and locked him away for years. They had only dragged him out to make him caliph after Wasif and Buga had absconded to Baghdad with his cousin, the pretender Al-Musta'in, who incidentally he despised. Early on in his reign, Al-Mu'taz reportedly told a small assembly of his supporters, "Won't you look at this band of lowly and foolish barbarians, whose hypocrisy has become famous and whose aspirations have become base? There is no way to restrain them. They have no discernment or scrutiny. Their rush into folly has extolled their evil deeds. Thus they became a minority, in spite of their numbers, and are always cursed wherever they are mentioned." So it's fair to say that Al-Mu'taz just really feared and loathed the Turkish slave army, the slave generals, and their friend and ally, that Turk-loving Abbasid prince Abu Ahmad. Al-Mu'taz knew that though in name he was the commander of the faithful, he was in reality merely a pawn of the slave army and the Turkish generals, and he tried desperately to get out from under their clutches. First, he appointed as his grand vizier a talented and capable bureaucrat of mixed Arab and Suryani heritage named Ahmad ibn Israel. Al-Tabari says that he also tried to appoint civilian officials throughout Iraq who were loyal to him. But this is also an indication that beyond Iraq, the authority of the caliph was by now quite limited. For all intents and purposes, it seems like the emirs were actually the ones in power outside of the Iraqi heartland even at this point, despite their protestations of loyalty to the caliph. Al-Mu'tazz also decided to do away with his hated cousin Al-Musta'in. Abu Ahmad and the Turkish generals had agreed with the Tahirids that Al-Musta'in would be allowed to go to the Hejaz. But Al-Mu'tazz then forbade this. Instead, Al-Musta'in was kept locked up in Baghdad until October 866, when Al-Mu'tazz felt that he was finally able to order his execution. Al-Musta'in was beheaded, and his decapitated head was brought to Al-Mu'tazz. According to Al-Tabari, when his head was brought to Al-Mu'tazz, the latter was playing chess. Told it was the head of the deposed, he said, "Put it there." Then he finished playing. Following that, the caliph had it brought to him. "So long, Al-Musta'in. We barely knew you. And indeed, you barely mattered, given that you were famously called a mere parrot for Turkish slave generals." Al-Mu'tazz then started going after the Turkish generals. While he knew that their friend and ally, Abu Ahmad, was too powerful to be got rid of, for now at least, he thought that he could at least get rid of Wasif and Buga, the two Turkish slave generals who had backed Al-Musta'in and brought him to Baghdad. And so, in October 866, the same time that he killed Al-Musta'in, Wasif and Buga and all of those who they had appointed were removed from state office. But outrage in the slave army at the caliph's removal of these men, despite the fact that they had fled to Baghdad with Al-Musta'in, forced Al-Mu'tazz to back down. For all the trouble that they had caused, Wasif and Buga the Younger still had a base of support in the slave army. According to Al-Tabari, a large contingent of Turkish troops showed up mounted and armed and expressed their belief that the caliph was making a mistake. And Al-Mu'tazz very sensibly agreed. Forced back from removing Wasif and Buga, Al-Mu'tazz then tried a different tack. According to Al-Tabari, he appointed a military force to bring to heel Turkish slave soldiers who were pillaging Iraq. During the chaos of the siege, as the anarchy consumed the state, some contingents of Turkish slave soldiers had taken advantage of the situation to just sort of wander around the rich lands of Iraq, pillaging and marauding as they liked. As the revenues of Iraqi farmland were absolutely critical to the state's budget, especially as the emirs in the provinces had ceased to send meaningful tax revenue to the caliph, this could not be tolerated. And it was also a good excuse to start clipping the wings of the slave army. In one of these engagements against one band of disorderly Turkish slave troops rampaging throughout Iraq, an Arab commander reportedly said to the Turks after defeating them, "Every day you kill one caliph, depose another, and kill a vizier." Which, yeah, that's pretty accurate. So by the middle of 867, it seems that Al-Mu'tazz had at least gotten control over Iraq. The rampaging bands of Turkish soldiers were finally quieted, though the center's authority outside of Iraq was by this point kind of limited. The new system of the emirates was evolving, it was coming into being, it was becoming entrenched day by day. Al-Mu'tazz finally caught a break when, due to delays in arrears and pay, Wasif was killed in a mutiny of his troops in October 867. And this issue, pay for the slave army, was really the main issue. As the caliph's tax revenues dried up due to the damage done to the complex Iraqi agricultural system, and no longer receiving tax revenues from the provinces, which were becoming more and more ruled by the emirs, the slave army became completely unaffordable. Al-Tabari reports that in 867, the yearly pay for the Turkish slave army equaled 2 years of tax revenues. That is, no longer did the slave army just consume over 50% of the state's budget. It now cost 200% of the state's budget. Now, this is obviously an impossible ask of the state's treasury, but the Turkish slave soldiers themselves did not understand this, of course. And so they became increasingly mutinous, increasingly hard to control. Reportedly, when his troops approached him menacingly, Wasif asked them, "What do you want?" And they said, "Our allotments." But there were simply no allotments to be had, and so Wasif died. In the words of Al-Tabari, "They hit him with axes until they broke his arms and decapitated him. Then they placed his head on top of a stick, which was used to stir bread in the ovens." Al-Mu'tazz appears to have used this incident and the increasing unruliness of the Turkish slave soldiers as an inroad to take out the Turkish slave general leadership. Within a month of Wasif's death, the Turk-loving Abu Ahmad, the Abbasid prince and the great ally of the slave generals, was imprisoned. Musa ibn Buga, the son of Buga the Elder, was in essence exiled to the frontiers. Then, in early 868, following a dispute with a younger, rising Turkish slave general named Bayakbak, Buga the Younger was imprisoned and then executed. Reportedly, when a Turkish slave soldier loyal to Bayakbak informed Al-Mu'tazz that he had captured Buga the Younger, the caliph responded, "Woe unto you if you do not bring me his head." The top slave generals and their Abbasid friend and ally were now out of the picture. Indeed, of the leading clique of generals who had led the conspiracy to assassinate Al-Mutawakkil 7 years earlier, only Musa ibn Buga was still alive. And I think this is as good of a place as any to stop and just reflect a bit on the crazy lives of these Turkish slave generals. All of them had begun their lives on the steppe before being captured and enslaved. I think of Wasif sitting in manacles in a Baghdad slave market, or Buga the Elder comforting his son Musa as they are led in bondage from the Khazar steppes to the barracks of Samarra. What must have been going through their heads as they left the steppe world of their youth in chains? Left the world of felt tents and herds and open vistas, and came into this alien world of barracks and mosques and caliphs. And they had all risen from that place, from that moment, to positions of power and influence and wealth that would have been literally impossible for them to even imagine when the chains were first placed on them. Though they formally remained slaves until their deaths, they very much became the masters of their own lives, and indeed of the lives of others. So now Al-Mu'tazz had managed to claw back power for the caliph, but it would prove to be temporary. He felt that he needed a counterweight to the might of the slave army, or he was not long for the throne, or even for this world. And so he turned to the Tahirids, the longtime viceroys of the East, these new powerful emirs, to support his regime. Essentially, in exchange for the caliph paying for the Baghdad garrison's upkeep, the Tahirids promised to support the caliph as required. Now this is a bit ironic. The slave army had of course initially been built during the reign of Al-Mu'tazz's ancestors in order to be a counterweight to Tahirid power. Now the situation was reversed. Nevertheless, with Tahirid support locked up, Al-Mu'tazz was now more or less the supreme power in the caliphate. He would last for about a year. See, this did not actually solve his problems. For one thing, he was actually just the supreme power of Iraq and the lands of the Hejaz. Outside of these lands, the real powers were the emirs, like the Tahirids, who were becoming increasingly more and more independent. As time passed, people in the provinces were becoming more and more used to the idea of the caliph as a symbolic leader, not the actual day-to-day ruler. What had started out as an improvised reaction to the chaos in the center, the lack of a clear caliph during the siege, was becoming more permanent. More importantly, and indeed related to this new independence of the emirs, was the basic problem of the state's revenues. The state was just not taking in enough money to fund its expenses, and in particular the expenses of the huge slave army. And perhaps most importantly of all, the slave army itself remained. The end of Wasif and Buga the Younger, the imprisonment of Abu Ahmad, and the exiling of Musa ibn Buga just created the space for new slave generals to rise up. The new, younger slave generals who rose in power were the son of Wasif, a guy named Salah ibn Wasif, and the slave general Bayakbak, who had finished off Buga the Younger. And this was basically inevitable. Getting rid of a couple slave generals didn't actually solve the basic problem. The slave army was simply too expensive to pay and also could not be gotten rid of. The Turkish slave soldiers had the arms, had the experience, had the military might. If you tried getting rid of them, they'd get rid of you. And if you didn't pay them, as indeed you could not, they would then do what steppe people tended to do when they wanted something from you and felt that you were weaker than them. They would kill you and take your stuff. I think it's also important to remember that the Turkish slave soldiers were coming from the steppe tradition. Though the Abbasid legal system saw them as slaves, they most likely saw their service as analogous to the traditional service to a powerful lord of the steppe, one that had obligations in both directions. And we've seen this before. Steppe warriors expect plunder and wealth as part of the deal. By failing to pay the army what they wanted, the caliphs and the generals were in effect failing in their duty as steppe lords. And we've seen this before, from Duobi to Ishbara to Suluk. The failure of a steppe lord to provide plunder and loot to his troops is almost always fatal. And so it would prove to be for Al-Mu'taz. As revenues continued to fall, he was forced to go back on the deal with the Tahirids. He was simply not able to pay for their troops in Baghdad and for the Samarran slave army. Al-Mu'taz thus lost his counterweight to the slave army. Without strong Tahirid support, by late 868, less than a year after his victory over his generals, he was already on very shaky ground. The end came for him in July 869. A group of Turkish slave soldiers, of course, requested a bonus. That son of Wasif, Salah ibn Wasif, led the men in demanding payment. The history of Al-Tabari relates the incident. They went to him on the 27th of Rajab. The caliph was shaken only by shouts of the people of Al-Khark and Al-Dur. Then suddenly, Salah ibn Wasif, Bayakbak, and Muhammad ibn Buga, who incidentally was Musa ibn Buga's brother, and the one known as Abu Nasr, entered with their weapons and stood by the door of the residence where Al-Mu'taz was staying. They sent word to him, "Come out to us." He sent word back, saying, "I took a medicine yesterday which caused me to panic 12 times. I am so weak that I cannot talk. If it is an urgent matter, let one of you enter and inform me of it. Let him see for himself why the matter which interests you is at a standstill." A group of the people from Al-Khark and Al-Dur, the lieutenants of the commanders, came in and dragged him to the room's door. He came out with his short turn in several places and traces of blood on his shoulders. They stood him in the sun in the palace at that time when the heat is oppressive. They started to call out to him, "Take it off," referring to the prophet's cloak. Then they brought him into a room connected by a door to his own room. This was the room where Musa ibn Buga used to stay when he was there. Following that, they sent out for Ibn Abi al-Shawarib, who was admitted together with a group of his men. Salah and his followers then said, "Write a letter of deposition for him." Al-Mu'taz was thus deposed by the Turkish slave soldiers. He was thrown into a cell and basically beaten to death over the course of 3 days. 3 days of essentially constant torture. Truly a horrible, horrible way to go. But I think on some level he must have feared and expected that this would always be his end. Done in by the slave army that he hated. In the aftermath of the murder of Al-Mu'taz, Salah ibn Wasif really consolidated his control among the slave soldiers and this new generation of generals. Bayakbak was sidelined, as were several other leading generals. The older Musa ibn Buga was safely out of town, serving in basically self-imposed exile on the Byzantine frontier. Salah ibn Wasif now set out to become the true power behind the throne. And of course, his primary motive was picking someone who he and his allies could dominate, and who wouldn't get crazy ideas about ruling himself. But Salah ibn Wasif and his junta faced a problem, Abu Ahmad. After Al-Mu'taz was beaten to death, the Turk-loving Abu Ahmad had been sprung from his jail cell and was now being hailed as a potential successor. And Abu Ahmad would have been a formidable caliph. The guy was very popular with the Turkish slave generals and the slave army, and he had commanded the siege of Baghdad. That just wouldn't do. And so Salah ibn Wasif and his allies rooted around the Abbasid family tree and landed on a guy named Al-Muqtadi. Al-Muqtadi was a son of Al-Watiq, the predecessor to the murdered Al-Mutawakkil, the man who had been considered the ideal caliph from the perspective of an ambitious Turkish slave general. A caliph defined by masterful inaction, as some would say. Salah ibn Wasif no doubt hoped that the son would be the same as the father. Abu Ahmad may have considered trying to contest the succession. He might have even reached out to his close friend Musa ibn Buga, but he must have ultimately decided that he lacked the forces necessary. And so he pledged his loyalty to al-Muqtadi and, claiming that he wanted to go on Hajj, then skipped town to go to Mecca. No doubt worried that his next adverse run-in with a caliph or his slave masters would result in him being sent to the gallows and not a jail cell. So by June 869, there was now a caliph. But he was a weak caliph, and spoiler alert, he's not going to be long for this world. The death of al-Mu'taz had further weakened the authority of the caliph's office and the control of the center over the provinces. Al-Mu'taz had, through careful balancing of the Tahirids and the slave army, managed to make the caliph's office yet again the most powerful office of the state, at least for about a year. But his murder at the hands of the slave army basically completely undid all of that. Al-Muqtadi also faced continued uprisings. Revolts had started just exploding everywhere since the anarchy began. As the slave army was tied up fighting for power, as the authority of the center weakened, it wasn't just emirs taking powers into their own hands in the name of the caliph. There were rebels challenging the caliphate itself. A Shia revolt had arisen in central and southern Iraq, and a Kharijite rebellion was beginning to unfold in northern Iraq and Syria, along with a brutal Ismaili Shia revolt in the center of Iraq. All of these required the slave army and the emirs to put down. Indeed, it's around this time that the Hamdanid Emirate in northern Iraq and Syria really started to emerge as a truly sovereign entity, largely because the Hamdanid family had taken over the administration of these northern territories and was critical to putting down Kharijite and Shia revolts. The most important of these revolts began in September 869 in southern Iraq, in the area around Basra. See, the Abbasids had previously imported large numbers of Bantu-speaking African slaves from the Swahili coast, the coast of what is now Kenya and Mozambique. The Arabic and Persian word for that area is Zanj, from which the Turkish word for African, Zenji, comes, and from which Zanzibar also takes its name. These African slaves were employed in draining the salt marshes of southern Iraq to turn them into valuable cropland. And this was particularly brutal work. Whereas the Turkish slave soldiers were generally high-ranking, high-status individuals, the work done here by the African slaves was horrifying. Really one of the worst forms of chattel slavery up until European cash crop plantation slavery. So naturally, as the anarchy raged, the African slaves decided, quite rightly, that they had had enough of this, and they launched a massive revolt against the faltering Abbasid state. It would rage for over 10 years, and it would be the most brutal of all of the rebellions against the caliphate, both in terms of the violence quite rightly inflicted by the slaves on their former masters, and in terms of the ruthlessness with which the Abbasids would put it down. Indeed, the revolt was so massive that al-Tabari devotes essentially the entire last volume of his history to it. But it's quite telling that what actually ended up finishing off al-Muqtadi was not these newly emerging emirates, or the rebellions against the caliph. He was instead done in by essentially the same thing that had done in al-Mu'taz, the inability to pay the Turkish slave soldiers what they wanted. The slave soldiers were expecting that al-Muqtadi would pay them a special donative upon ascending to the throne, equivalent to 10 months of salary. But here's the thing, the state just didn't have the money to do that. And remember that Sulla ibn Wasif had overthrown al-Mu'taz over a salary dispute. So the rank-and-file slave soldiers were really expecting him to pull through here. And so Sulla ibn Wasif began scraping together everything that he could get his hands on to pay this bonus, even confiscating private wealth of the late caliph's mother and other prominent citizens. This did not make him popular with the non-Turkish slave soldier population, but even after doing this, he still fell short. So now even his popularity with the soldiers was on shaky ground. By December 869, 6 months into al-Muqtadi's reign, or I guess we should say his so-called reign as he basically had no power at all, Musa ibn Buga and Abu Ahmad felt confident enough to try to overthrow the weakening Sulla ibn Wasif. Musa ibn Buga rode in from the Byzantine borderlands with what troops he could get his hands on. which incidentally made the Hamdanid emirs in the north more powerful, as the center's remaining troops in the region were yet again withdrawn. Leading slave generals sidelined by Sulla ibn Wasif, including Bayakbak, came over to Musa's side. Sulla became increasingly isolated. Upon arriving in Samarra, Musa instructed the caliph to punish Sulla for stealing people's wealth to give to the soldiers, whereupon Sulla went into hiding. But the Turkish slave soldiers, not really liking what Musa ibn Buga was saying about how it was wrong to take from people to give to the army, mutinied, and they began to rampage through the city in support of Sulla. Musa thereupon ordered his soldiers to put down the mutiny, and in a hard day of bloody fighting, the mutiny was crushed. Shortly thereafter, Sulla ibn Wasif was found in his hiding place and was promptly executed. Musa ibn Buga and Bayakbak now stood triumphant in Samarra. Al-Tabari reports a truly remarkable meeting between them and al-Muqtadi's agent. In this meeting, the Turkish generals laid out 6 demands, some of which deal with the ranks of the soldiers, but most of which centered around money. Essentially, al-Muqtadi was forced to agree to guarantee the Turks the rights to estates, state revenue streams, and tax farming rights that they had been granted for certain areas, which were termed ikta. Al-Muqtadi was forced to accept these demands, but he was not happy about this whole situation. He didn't like Bayakbak or Musa ibn Buga and rightly saw them both as being extremely dangerous to his life. It would be incredibly easy for them to replace him, perhaps with Abu Ahmad, who was still camped out in Mecca. He hated how he had been forced to essentially mortgage the state to pay off the slave soldiers. So rather stupidly, he began to conspire against them. While Musa ibn Buga was out of Samarra trying to put down the Kharijite rebellion unfolding in northern Iraq and in Syria, al-Muqtadi had his brother Muhammad arrested and executed on charges of embezzlement. Bayakbak was also arrested. As you can imagine, this infuriated Musa, who rode back to Samarra, sprung Bayakbak from jail, and then got his hands on the duplicitous caliph. Al-Muqtadi was swiftly executed, having lasted for less than a year on the throne. Yet again, the Turkish slave soldiers had done in a caliph, and yet again the authority of the caliph's office continued to slip. Commanders of the faithful indeed. And it was here, at the nadir of its fortunes, that Abu Ahmad stepped forward to salvage something of a future for the Abbasid dynasty. Upon hearing the news of al-Muqtadi's death while sitting in self-imposed exile in Mecca, Abu Ahmad rushed back to Samarra, now firmly in the hands of his friend, Musa ibn Buga. There, Musa ibn Buga, Bayakbak, and Abu Ahmad agreed that the next caliph would be al-Mu'tamid, who assumed the caliphate on June 16, 870. Now, we can't be sure why Abu Ahmad didn't claim the throne for himself. Perhaps he was far too canny to want the job. Perhaps the Turkish slave generals didn't actually want an Abbasid prince with such a strong connection to the troops on the throne. Likely it was a little bit of both. Regardless, the reign of al-Mu'tamid would come to mark the end of the anarchy. Now, there's no reason that this would necessarily have to be the case. And indeed, sitting there at the time, there would have been no way to see this. Al-Mu'tamid looked like any other of the recent caliphs. Some guy plucked out of nowhere by the Turkish slave army. He probably seemed destined to serve for at best a couple of years before getting killed by some gang of slave soldiers, just like had happened to his 4 predecessors. But this was not to be the case. Likely general exhaustion with the chaos played a role here, but far more important was the great skill of Abu Ahmad and Musa ibn Buga. Of course, they did not actually give power to the caliph. I mean, come on, that would be crazy. But they skillfully built a workable system of government centered around Abu Ahmad. Abu Ahmad stood as the liaison between the Turkish slave soldiers and the non-Turkish civil administration. As the one Abbasid prince beloved by the slave army, a man who may have even spoken Turkish himself, who had commanded the Samarran military at the siege of Baghdad, and who was personally close friends with the leading slave generals, in particular Musa ibn Buga, he was acceptable to the Turkish military. But he was also an Abbasid prince, an educated man with a noble lineage. He was acceptable to the civil administration of the state and to the people, most importantly the nobility. So what Abu Ahmad did was essentially separate the caliph's spiritual power and role as the legitimizer of the state from temporal power, from actual government. While the caliph's name appeared on coins and Friday prayers were read in his name, it was Abu Ahmad who ran the government, led the army, and appointed the officers. Abu Ahmad acted quickly to take actions that would be welcomed by the Turkish slave soldiers who supported him. He immediately got rid of the few remaining non-Turkish slave regiments, the Iranians and the Berbers. From now on, the slave army would be entirely Turkish. But Abu Ahmad also tried to limit the power of the slave army. He did this by tying the Turkish troops more closely to his person, essentially by cycling the Turkish slave soldiers out through the military. He had come to believe that the main problem was Turkish officers becoming entrenched and developing their own webs of patronage and loyalty, rising to the heights that his friend Musa ibn Buga had, for example. Abu Ahmad wanted to make the slave army an actual slave army, with soldiers who actually listened to their commanders. So to do this, he actually ended up expanding the purchase and training of new slaves from Central Asia, seeking to continually refresh the ranks of the army while manumitting the more seasoned soldiers and sending them either back home to the steppe or out to the provinces. In this way, he hoped that the webs of patronage and loyalty among gangs of Turkish slave soldiers would be harder to form and maintain. The army would be tied to him personally. Additionally, as part of this consolidation of power, Abu Ahmad began the process of moving the capital back to Baghdad, away from the garrison city of Samarra and its not entirely loyal army. This move would take a while and would only be completed by his son, who would reign as caliph himself. But how to pay the soldiers? As we've said earlier, the fundamental cause of the anarchy, at the most basic level, was the inability of the state to pay out the hard cash bonuses that the slave army demanded. Well, that basic situation hadn't really changed. If anything, it had gotten worse. As wars in Iraq devastated the intricate and delicate irrigation system, agricultural yields fell in the heartland of the caliphate, and that was the only place now generating significant tax revenue for the center. The provinces had already stopped sending money to Samarra. As we will get to shortly, particularly important was the rise of the Turkish slave Tulinid dynasty in Egypt in the late 860s and early 870s, which ended the already dwindling tax receipts from Egypt. And the Turks in Samarra themselves had essentially looted the treasury bare already. Essentially, the state was broke. The solution was essentially that tax farm that I briefly mentioned earlier, the ikta. And it was under Abu Ahmad's de facto rule that the practice of granting the ikta became increasingly entrenched. The holder of an ikta had the right to collect the tax from a given area, send a certain amount to the treasury, and then keep the difference. Now, this had precedence. High-ranking officials had long received rights to revenue in connection with their offices, but the ikta were different. They were of varying sizes, not just tied to some grand office of state, and so they could be given to just random Turkish officers. And though in the beginning they had to be confirmed by new rulers, in practice they quickly became a piece of personal property, one that could be passed down through inheritance. And perhaps more importantly, the ikta slowly began to also have the right to administer the territory attached to it. So much like the knights of Europe, the Turkish slave soldiers were now being paid to fight with what amounted to a mini fief. The ikta system born out of the anarchy would continue long into the future, and it would be greatly expanded and developed under the Seljuks. Indeed, it would last in some form until the Ottoman administrative reforms of the 18th and 19th centuries. So as Abu Ahmad and Musa ibn Buga stabilized the political situation within Samarra, they could now turn to putting down the revolts against the caliphate and hopefully rein in the emirs. Now, there were just revolts everywhere by this point. Virtually every corner of the caliphate was home to its own revolt against either the caliph in Iraq or the emirs now effectively ruling the provinces. But Abu Ahmad and Musa ibn Buga knew that they had to focus on Iraq. Before they could hope to reassert the caliph's authority over the emirs, they had to control the heartland. and that meant putting down the Shia revolt in the center of Iraq, the Kharijite revolt in the north of Iraq, and above all, the massive revolt of the African slaves around Basra in the south of Iraq, the Zanj Revolt. But the Zanj Revolt was so massive that it would basically consume all of the state's resources. Musa ibn Buga would spend the rest of his life, until his death in 877, leading the caliphate's ruthless war against the Zanj. This was a desperate war of unseen brutality against a Zanj insurgency in the marshes of southern Iraq. Like many modern insurgency wars, the imperial troops held the cities, while the countryside fell to the rebels. The insurgent African slaves would strike contingents of Abbasid Turkish slave soldiers and then melt back into the marsh. They would sack the large cities and towns controlled by the caliphate. Eventually, they would even succeed in sacking Basra itself. Meanwhile, the Turkish troops would just put whole villages to the sword. The war also did irreparable damage to the incredibly complicated irrigation system of southern Iraq, leading to a massive collapse of agricultural yields and mass starvation. We don't know the number of deaths, but it's estimated to be between 1.5 and 2.5 million people. That's just a shocking figure for this time and place. Al-Tabari catalogs hundreds of atrocities and thousands of deaths, and Al-Masudi provides one of the most chilling descriptions of the horror when describing the starvation that gripped the population of southern Iraq. A large number of people hid among the houses and in the wells. They appeared only at night and hunted dogs, rats, and cats. Then they ate the corpses of their companions who had died, and they watched each other, waiting for someone to die. The stronger killed their comrades and devoured them. Meanwhile, Abu Ahmad led troops out to viciously put down revolts of the Shia in central Iraq and the Kharijites in northern Iraq. Now, eventually, all of this would be accomplished. The caliphate's control over Iraq was reasserted by the end of the 870s, and even the Zanj revolt would be brutally crushed by the early 880s. In time, Abu Ahmad was victorious. But this had required all of the state's power, all of the military might of the Turkish slave army, all of the state's remaining resources. Everything had been used to restore Abbasid control over the Iraqi heartland. And that meant that outside of the Iraqi heartland, the rule of the caliphate now fell permanently to the emirs. Abu Ahmad had been able to stabilize the center, but he was not able to reassert the center's power over the provinces. And even in the center, irreparable damage had been done to the caliph's ability to rule. For one thing, as we have discussed, even in the center, the caliph had become a figurehead. Actual power now lay with Abu Ahmad. Now, Abu Ahmad does appear to have been trying to solve this by making sure that his son Al-Mutaddid would succeed Al-Mutamid to be the next caliph. He likely hoped that by appointing his son as the next caliph, the role of head of government and head of religion, for lack of better words, would be recombined. But spoiler alert, it's not really going to work. There's still going to be conflict between the caliph and the Turkish slave army right up until the Seljuks finally put paid to the whole system. Abu Ahmad would die in 891 in Baghdad. His son would take over as caliph a year later. With great skill, and indeed against the odds, Abu Ahmad had salvaged something of a future for the Abbasid lineage out of the chaos of the anarchy. But the role of caliph had been fundamentally transformed. The idea that the role of caliph and the role of emir, that is, spiritual power and temporal power, were actually separate was now permanent. And though the Abbasids would have some limited success in temporarily reconquering parts of the caliphate lost to the emirs, their power would wane more than it would wax. And even in Baghdad itself, the caliphs would still continue to weaken, losing power to their generals and their civil administrators. When the coming caliph al-Radi dies in 940, the then-leading Turkish slave general Baykam will just send his secretary to Baghdad with instructions on who to appoint. So low had the prestige of the office fallen, and so far was it from actual temporal power. And indeed, I think this is one of the longest-lasting and most important impacts of the anarchy at Samarra, the separation of mosque and state. Now, of course, the state would remain intrinsically and intimately bound up with religion in the Muslim world for centuries, really until the modern era. But before the anarchy, there was no difference at all between spiritual and temporal power in the Muslim world. The state had been built by Muhammad and his successors, the caliphs, from the religious community. The state flowed from the religious community. They were in fact essentially the same thing. Succession to the messenger meant succession to the state. Well, no longer. Though the state would be bound up with religion, as indeed was the case everywhere in the world at this time, the state no longer was the religion. In the immediate term, though, even more important than the weakening of the caliph within the center was the weakening of the center with respect to the periphery. Now, these are, of course, connected phenomena. Each reinforced the other. But it was here, in the inability of the central authority to control the provinces, that the institution of the caliphate really changed forever. Even if a caliph could regain total power in the center, they would never be lords of more than Iraq and maybe the lands of the Hejaz. And even if a caliph was totally under the thumb of a Turkish slave general, that slave general would never rule more than those same lands directly, at least for very long. Think about what has just happened over the last 10 years from the perspective of someone outside of Samarra and Baghdad. Imagine that you are an emir, a local lord in some part of Iran or Syria or Egypt. Ever since al-Mutawakkil was murdered by the Turkish slave army, the capital has been in near constant turmoil, and it hasn't given you any real practical help or instruction at all. The Turkish slave soldiers have propped up one caliph after another, including guys who were just like some random cousin of the royal house. The slave army even besieged the great city of Baghdad, the greatest city in the world. Why should you respect any caliph at all? And in any event, whoever the slave army props up this time is going to have no power and will in all likelihood be done in by some other gang of Turkish slaves in a couple years anyway. You've been putting down rebellions left and right without any help from Samarra. So why should you really have to listen to whoever the slave army props up next? What even makes this new guy, whoever he is, a real caliph, a real commander of the faithful? Everyone knows he's just a parrot of some clique of Turkish slaves. Why should you even care about this? And coupled with this, there was now a new breed of emir. New guys coming to power in the 10 years of chaos. The original proto-emirs had been local lords, local officials, who took local government into their own hands as the central government fell into chaos. The Tahirids are actually sort of the best example of this. Powerful viceroys of the East who had long roots in the region. A recognized local dynasty close to the caliphs who had long exercised power and influence in the region they ruled based on an understanding with Samarra. Similarly, in the north of Iraq and Syria, when Musa ibn Buga had left the region to fight for the throne in Iraq, a local Arab noble family called the Hamdanids had taken over the administration of the state. When Abu Ahmad and Musa ibn Buga were occupied in regaining control over central and southern Iraq, the Hamdanids had put down Kharijite and Shia revolts and had emerged as a truly sovereign emirate. But new emirs were arising, who did not have a long history of power in the regions they ruled, and who were correspondingly less tied to the caliphs. In Egypt, a Turkish slave general named Ahmad ibn Tulun had been appointed governor by al-Mutaz in 868, shortly before his murder. While by the mid-870s, Tulun had become an effectively independent emir. A Turkish slave commander with no great family history of loyalty to the caliph or even any relation to Egypt at all. Abu Ahmad had been particularly concerned with Tulun and had hoped to remove him from Egypt and return it to Abbasid rule, but as the Zanj revolt had unfolded, he just didn't have the troops to do the job. And so the Tulunid dynasty not only held on in Egypt, but went on to conquer the Levant and a large part of Syria. And by the time the Zanj revolt was finished in the early 880s, this Turkish emirate in Egypt was just too well entrenched. And even after the Tulunids were briefly toppled by the Abbasids, Egypt would shortly come to be taken over by the Shia Fatimids. And the Fatimids would of course claim the title of caliph for themselves. They didn't even recognize the Abbasids at all. Another of these new emirs was basically a Bedouin adventurer who managed to set himself up in Palestine before traveling to what's now southern Turkey and creating an emirate there. Meanwhile, on the Byzantine borderlands, Local Arab generals turned emirs, and Armenian and Georgian princes had set themselves up as petty mountain warlords, ruling a patchwork of what amounted to tiny city-states. And as we will discuss next time, as the Tahirids weakened in the east, Iranian dynasties founded by local gentry and lower-ranking nobles were now already arising to take their place. The power of the caliphate had fractured, both geographically into different emirates and between the temporal and spiritual power of the caliph. Outside of Iraq, the rule of the provinces was now in the hands of the emirs. And everywhere throughout the caliphate, the idea of the caliph as a spiritual leader had been split off from the idea of the caliph as a temporal leader. Now, the caliph still held power as a spiritual leader. He still had that spiritual role, and we should not think of him as being totally powerless. Indeed, his role as legitimizer of the emirs was incredibly important. By recognizing their right to rule, he was in essence ordaining them as proper Islamic rulers, which was critical to legitimizing the emirs in the eyes of their subjects, most importantly to the religious and civil administration that actually ran their emirates. Remember that the emirates started off by basically taking over the existing Abbasid governmental structures in a time of crisis. While those structures remained the core of the government system of the emirates, and the educated and sophisticated Arabs and Persians who ran them would really prefer it if the leader had a stamp of approval from the commander of the faithful. Recognition by the caliph was a greatly important mark of legitimacy in such a religious time and place. It was how an emir could get his nobles and officials to listen to him, and something he could wave in the face of his rival emirs to show them that he had the right to rule in his domains. And because it was so valuable, it did give the caliph a measure of influence over the emirs, even if he no longer had control over them. So this was the political world that the anarchy created. Really, this was a new vision of what the caliphate was. No longer was the caliph the commander of the faithful, the spiritual and temporal leader of the great empire of faith. Instead, this was a new system of a patchwork of emirates, in practice ruling most of the lands of the caliphate, with only the lands of Iraq and the Hejaz, the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, directly under the rule of the caliph. And even there, actual temporal rule was mostly in the hands of Turkish slave soldiers and the civil administration. The caliph was now really just the spiritual leader of the Sunni Muslim world, a man of great influence, indeed with a great deal of political power, but no longer a temporal ruler in a meaningful sense. The commander of the faithful had in effect lost his ability to command, though he retained an ability to influence, to cajole, to pressure, and to recognize. He was no longer the ruler of the empire of faith. He was instead the spiritual legitimizer of the temporal rulers of the Muslim world. You know, a lot of people try to make analogies between this new system and the contemporaneous feudal system in Europe. And indeed, there are some analogies. In Europe, the Pope would recognize kings and princes who would actually rule, and the Iktas system clearly does have some analogies to European fiefs. But there are some real differences. Most importantly, this new system was philosophically based on the caliph's delegation of power to the emirs. While the popes would eventually rule the papal states in Italy directly, they didn't start out as like the temporal rulers of all of Europe. I think better analogies are to the last years of the Western Roman Empire, when the Roman emperors basically delegated their right to rule out to the mighty German kings and chieftains, who had invaded and occupied huge portions of Europe. Similarly here, the Turkish slave generals from beyond the frontiers took the right to rule the center, while local lords were delegated the right to govern huge portions of the caliphate. Another great analogy is the Sengoku period in Japan, where local daimyo, the provincial samurai leadership, were effectively delegated the right to rule by the imperial court in Kyoto. The imperial court remained in place, but the traditional elites took over the actual administration of the state outside of Kyoto itself. This system, this intermezzo, would really continue until the coming of the Seljuks, and even the Seljuks would continue to work within the broad contours of this system. When the Seljuks seize power, they will in essence reunite the fractured temporal power of the state, but they will not attempt to reunite the temporal power with the spiritual power. The Abbasid caliphs would remain as the spiritual leaders, legitimizing the exercise of power by the coming Seljuk sultans. But for now, the caliphate has been splintered, the spiritual authority of the caliph separated from the temporal power of the emirs, and the territory of the Empire of Faith split up among the various emirates themselves. And so next time, we will travel back to the east, to the lands of Central Asia, to discuss an emirate that would be destined to not only bring Islam to the Turks, but would indeed be destined to bring a man named Seljuk into the Islamic world.